Okay, I think we should talk about Shemitah. About Shemitah, even though this is not a Shemitah year, but it was a Shemitah year in the recent past. So if you look at the Pasukim at the beginning of our... the first Pasuk on the sheet is a Pasuk in the parish of Mishpatim, right, where Shemitah is mentioned. The second pasuk on the sheet are the psukim at the beginning of our parasha. So you know that there's a big issue made out of Bahar Sinai, which we're not going to talk about. But we have talked about it in the past. What I want to talk about is the second pasuk, which says, Daber b'nei Yisrael matah lehem ki tavo el ha'aretz, asher nitten lechem v'shavta ha'aretz, Shabbat Lashem. V'shavta ha'aretz. The land will rest. And then it says Shabbat Lashem. Shabbat Lashem, the Rishonim thought was a difficult phrase. Because it sounds like you're giving something to God. Shabbat Lashem. And no one could make sense out of that. No one could make sense out of that because... if you keep a mitzvah, it's not obvious that you're giving something to God. What exactly you are doing is also not obvious, but you're certainly not giving anything to God. So v'shavta ha'aret Shabbat Lashem became a difficult phrase. Rashi takes care of it here, and in many other places we have a similar problem. You see, where is the Rashi? The Rashi is at the bottom. You see Shabbat Lashem? Shabbat Lashem, the bottom of the Rashi, L'shem Hashem. L'shem Hashem means for God's sake, for the glory of God. It doesn't mean that you give something to God. It just means that you're aware of the fact, like what we call Kavanah. You're aware of the fact that you're doing it because God instructed you to do it. But you're not giving anything to God. Right? Not giving anything to God. So this problem of Shabbat Lashem, connects to the general idea of mitzvot and their rationale. It was very popular at a certain time in Jewish history to try to figure out why God wants us to do what God wants us to do. Now, for some mitzvot, it's obvious because the Torah itself explains, right? Sit in a sukkah on Sukkot because then you'll remember what was going on. Eat a matzah on Pesach because you'll remember that when the Jews left Mitzrayim, they ate a matzah. Some mitzvot are not so easy. In fact, they're very difficult. Now, one of the people who really went into this at great length was the Rambam. And the Rambam in the Mora Nebuchim, in the Guide to the Perplexed, the Rambam tries to explain almost every mitzvah in the Torah. But he goes through the halachot in the way he set it up in the Yad HaZakah. And every time he comes to a group of mitzvot, he tries to explain why that mitzvah was demanded. And usually the rationale of the Rambam divides into two major categories. One has to do with Avodah Zarah. There are many mitzvot where the Rambam says it was kind of retraining. We're being retrained in order to avoid Avodah Zarah. One of those mitzvot which annoyed others, like the Ramban, that the Rambam says has something to do with the Avodah Zarah problem, is Korbanot. Is the mitzvah of sacrifice in the Beit HaMikdash. And the Rambam says, well, since everybody did it, and since idolatry was rampant, so, I mean, as you can imagine, there might be some difference of opinion about what the Rambam actually said. What I'm telling you is what the Ramban, in the beginning of Vayikra, says that the Rambam said, according to the translation of the Mora Nebuchim by Al-Khariz. There were two famous translations of the Mor Nevuchim. One was by Shmuel Ibn Tibun, who came from a family of translators. They translated everything from Arabic into Hebrew. But there was another translation of the Mor Nevuchim by a poet. He wasn't a translator necessarily, he was a poet, Al-Kharizi, and that was the translation that the Ramban used in to study the Mor Nevuchim. I hope that was not too complicated a sentence. So the Ramban quotes the Mor Nevuchim in the beginning of his commentary on Vayikra, not the, like Pasuk Gimel or something, from the translation of Al-Kharizi. And the Ramban says that the Rambam said that the reason God legislated korbanot was in order to get us away from the korbanot of the idolaters. Somehow the Rambam thought that this would be a great attraction, you know, being able to sacrifice, and that if the Torah hadn't permitted sacrifices, we would all run away and seek out sacrificial locations, and we, you know, where we could do whatever it is we wanted to do. And therefore, that's the first category. It's a big category of mitzvot, according to the Rambam, which are anti-avodah zarah mitzvot. The second category for the Rambam is pragmatic. Mitzvot are good for you. They organize life in a good way. They take care of problems. They do the right thing. All of that is the second large category. So here on this page, you have a long quote from the Guide to the Perplexed, which I will try to read. It's not easy if you can't see, but I'll try. As to the precepts of mitzvot enumerated in the laws concerning the year of release and the jubilee. Jubilee is Yovel. Some of them imply sympathy with our fellow men and promise the well-being. What? And
promote.
Oh, you could put up with that, no? Promote the well-being of mankind. For in reference to those precepts, it is stated in the law that the poor of thy people may eat. And besides, the land will also increase its produce and improve when it remains fallow for some time. In fact, you know, it's interesting that in the Chumash, it says that you have to believe that it'll all turn out. That this mitzvah of Shemitah is a mitzvah that is kind of connected to your fundamental belief in the divine promise. And the Rambam says, no, it's a practical thing. If you don't work the land once in 7 years, everybody will be happy, the land will be happy, and you will be happy, because you're going to get next year, you're going to get more potatoes out of the land. He doesn't mention the fact that the mitzvah itself, as it is stated in the Torah, is a mitzvah of faith. I mean, that itself is a question. That's a question. The Rambam goes on in this vein. You have it there. If you want to look at it, you can look at it. What I want to look at now is the Kli Yakar. You see the Kli Yakar on the page? Rav Ephraim Lunchitz, who was a Talmid of the Maharal. And at the end of the Maharal's life, when he was an old man, he was the Maharal, his last stage. It was interesting, because everybody thinks that the Maharal must have been in Prague all his life, but in fact, he was not. He came to Maharal, came to Prague the second time, or the third time, pretty late in life, and he became the chief rabbi of Prague. But when he was old and frail, he couldn't do it. He just couldn't do it. So the Kli Yakar became his kind of either associate rabbi or assistant rabbi. He became also the active chief rabbi in Prague. So he was the outstanding student of the Maharal. And he wrote a Perush on Chumash, which somehow was included in Mikraot Gedolot. I'm not sure why. I guess it fit the space somehow. There was like that much empty space.
It looks like that.
Well, But it's in all the editions of Mikraot Gidolot that include Rishonim and Achronim, which I'm leaving out what's called the Torat Chaim,
right?
The Moser of Rav Kook, Torat Chaim, Mikraot Gidolot, only has Rishonim in it, right? That's their thing. That, you know, the study of Torah ended in 1200, that was it, you know. So, but the other traditional, more traditional Mikraot Gedolot also contain Achronim, notably the Kli Yakar and the Orach Chaim. Those are the two commentaries that they always include in the standard versions of the Mikraot Gedolot. So there you have it. You have to buy both. If you don't have both, you're missing out. So Shefta Arashah, but this is the Kli Yakar. So the Kli Yakar wrote a very long, very digressive, sometimes quite interesting commentary on the Torah. It is sometimes very interesting. So look at what he says. He says, "B'tam mitzvah zo, yesh de'ot chalukot." There are different opinions about this mitzvah, the mitzvah of Shemitah. Ki rabim omrim, shatam hu, shetishbot ha'aretz kidei shetosif teit kochah lizroa. He says, many say that the reason Shemitah exists is to give the land a rest, and when after it rests, it will produce better. It'll be a better kind of a producer. As we just saw, and this is the opinion of the Rambam in the Moreh Nebuchim. The Kli Yakar says, "Rabim chalkim alav." Va'amru, there are those who disagree with him, and they say, "Sheim chashasha atorah laze shelo techalesha adama." Lama yitchayvu galut al shmitat ha'aretz yiyah ansham shelo tosif ha'aretz teit kolcha lahem. So the Kli Yakar doesn't understand. He's quoting other Mefarshim. He says, if this were true, that the reason you let the land lie fallow for a year is because you wanted to produce on a high level production, and that would not be the case if you didn't let it lie fallow. So the Rambam says, the Kli Yakar says, so how come the Torah says that if you don't keep Shemitah, you're going to go into exile? Why should the punishment be going into exile? The punishment will be that you won't get produce. The thing is not going to work, so that's a punishment. Why do you have to get rid of the Jews from Eretz Yisrael? So he says, Rabim cholkim alav v'mushim chshasha Torah lezeh shelo techalesh adama lama yitchayvu galut al shmitat ha'aretz ye'on sham shelo tosif ha'aretz teit kolcha lahem v'od she'en zeh shabbat l'shem. He says, furthermore, we're stuck with these two words at the end of the pasuk, shabbat l'shem, which is where we started. I looked at the Rashi. Why is this called Shabbat Lashem? If you keep the Shemitah, if the purpose of keeping the Shemitah is that the grass should grow faster, or that the seed should produce a better result, I mean, why is that called Shabbat Lashem? The way he says it is, so where is the Shabbat Lashem? Where is Shabbat Lashem in this process? Ki im letzorech ha'aretz, ki im letzorech ha'aretz, right? But because you're doing it for the land, not for God. It's not, you know, it's like, this is the nature. This is like, you know, somebody did a study and came up with the fact that you should do this, rotate the crops somehow, and then you're going to have a better result. So good, what's it got to do? It's not Shabbat Lashem, it's Shabbat La'aretz. Kiyim letzorech ha'aretz. Umahu she'amar az tirtze ha'aretz et shabtoteha. Ma tarviach bazeh she'yigalu mimenu Yisrael v'yishuva la'agoyim asher lo'olam ba ya'avodu ve'en Eich tishbot ha'aretz v'shama mehem. So he says, after you exile the Jews from Eretz Yisrael, so Goyim are going to move in. Now they're certainly not going to keep Shemitah. They're certainly not going to be, you know, sensitive to the needs of the land. So what was the point? What's the point? So this is all a way of opposing the position of the Rambam. The Rambam says it's a pragmatic matter, and the Kli Yakar says, what do you mean pragmatic? And why do you have all these add-ons? Galut, exile, and then the people are going to come in and live there, and they're certainly not going to keep Shemitah. The whole thing doesn't make sense in according to the Rambam. According to the Rambam. Then he goes on, and he says, "Uba Akedah Natan Ta'am Acher." Akedah is a sefer Akedah, Yitzhak Arama, right? Did I get it right? Yitzhak Arama, it's spelled the opposite of what you think. It's an ayin when you think it should be an olive, and it's an olive when you think it should be an ayin. So Arama is ayin, resh, mem, aleph, hey. Yitzhak Arama. He wrote a commentary on Chumash, which is sort of like, it's written like essays. Like he raises a problem and he discusses it. You know, like, He was kind of a philosopher. You know, philosophy meant Greek philosophy. Everybody knew the same philosophy. Even the Kabbalists were like Greek philosophers. That was all there was. So Bakeda, Natan Tam Acheva Mar, Shetachlit Mitzvah Zo, Lezecha Chidusha Olam, Velizko Yemot Olam. So he says, oh, it's like Shabbos. I mean, that's Akedah. He says, Shemitah, like Shabbos, it says Shabbos. So what is Shabbos? Shabbos is about remembering, right? You know, there's a mitzvah on Shabbat called Zachor. How do you do the mitzvah of Zachor? You make Kiddush. I mean, that's how we do it. We make Kiddush. So the mitzvah, so making Kiddush Friday night on Shabbat is a mitzvah min HaTorah. That's how you do it. You say, it's Shabbos. So Chazal thought that was a little tacky, so they made it into a kind of, enough words so you could sing it with a little tune. What?
I think we light the candles is the same.
Candles are only a minhag. I mean, it was established to take care of an objective problem. Zachor et Yom HaShabbat is something that, only because the Torah says it, that we do it. Otherwise, we wouldn't do it. Lighting candles in your house takes care of an objective problem. And the objective problem is it's dark. So it makes light. And people wouldn't eat the meal on Shabbat, Friday night, in order to save wax. To save the cost of the candles. So the Chachamim instituted this idea that you have to light candles of course, so that you could eat on Shabbos. It didn't matter anymore. No?
Well, until you make Kiddush, you haven't fulfilled the Zohar.
Then what?
So until you make or hear Kiddush, you haven't fulfilled the Zohar.
Today, yeah, that people, they you know, there's regular questions. I mean, if you daven Maariv, so you mention Shabbat. It Maariv. So you have to be a little tricky and say that since you know that somebody's going to make Kiddush when you get home, even though you mentioned the Shabbat during the Tefillah, you don't really mean it. In other words, theoretically, any time you say, walk in the street and say Good Shabbos to somebody, you've theoretically fulfilled the mitzvah of Zachor. Because midoraita, there's no nusach. There's nothing you're supposed to say. You're just supposed to say, it's Shabbos. So when you go home, when you get out of shul, men get out of shul Friday night. Usually men go to shul, and women don't on Friday night. I'm not taking a stand on the greater issues. But you say, everybody says, Good Shabbos. So when you say Good Shabbos, that is a statement about the day. And that's a fulfillment of Zachor. That's a fulfillment of Zachor. Some people say, no, you could only fulfill the Zachor in Hebrew. which is why sometimes people are makbid to say good Shabbos and not to say Shabbat Shalom. Because you say Shabbat Shalom, you're involved in a halachic issue. What's the halachic? What's the halachic issue? You see, things that we can really get complicated.
Yeah.
What's the halachic issue? If you say Shabbat Shalom, what's the halachic issue? When you go home, you want to make kiddush. When you make kiddush, you want to be motzi everybody around the table. All the women around the table who are also chayav to say kiddush, right, to say zachor et yom shabbat lekadesh. All these women, they're still chayav midoraisa. But the man who's going to make kiddush is not chayav midoraisa because he said shabbat shalom to somebody along the way.
And you're
right, Davin. Yeah, well, we took care of davening because we said it doesn't count. He says, so now I have to say saying Shabbat Shalom also doesn't count. Why do you look incredulous?
Because I'm to praise it, right? The question
what?
Is really good.
What is it? The question's good.
The Gemara says, like saying Shabbat Shalom is enough for Shabbat Tuvu, which anyway, the Gemara talks about saying it in Aramaic. So, but then why shouldn't lighting candles be enough for a woman?
Wait a second. What are you saying? I didn't get it.
She's also saying a Shabbos.
Oh, a woman.
It sounds like a wedding.
Not all the women in the house light candles. I mean, you want to get...
But one who does.
Okay, so I didn't talk about that one. I was talking about the other one.
And you can say a Shefi Adel on it. Right?
Wait a second. I was just explaining what Shabbat is.
So the solution is when you get home, you need to find a woman who didn't light candles to do kiddush.
Yeah.
Why not? Who heard it here first?
So
this is going on the internet.
The highest authorities have declared that since you know that you're going to have to make kiddush, right? You know you're going to have to make kiddush. So then when you say Shabbat Shalom, you don't mean it. Which is not something we want to publicize because it's very unfriendly. It's like an unfriendly position. But that's the way out. That's the way out. Now, this solution is suggested by Akiva Eger, who was not in the minor leagues in the halakhic world. You know, he was a power hitter.
It's true, though, that when you say Shabbat Shalom, you don't mean I'm going to Nam Kadesh Hayom. You mean, hello, how are you?
Yeah, no, but doesn't you say hello, but you don't say Shabbat Shalom on Thursday.
True.
So there's something to it. Okay. I'm not interested in mothers. Okay.
You can say this, you can say that.
Wednesday. Yeah, but it doesn't count.
You have to say
it on Shabbos. That's the whole thing.
Yeah.
So the Akedah said it's Shabbos, just like Shabbos, so too Shemitah. That's what he said. So just like Shabbos reminds you of the creation of the world, 6 days and the seventh day, so Shemitah also reminds you of the creation of the world, whatever it is you want it to remind you of. V'chein katav Rav Yitzchak Bar Benel also was very good at summarizing things. You know, he liked that. He liked to summarize. He wrote a very long commentary on the entire Tanakh. Because Rav Yitzchak Bar Benel worked for a living. So he didn't have time to do the rest. You know, he just wrote his commentary on the whole of Tanakh. And he says, Vosif od nofech mishalo, Vigam zera chok mikiliotai, right? It doesn't absorb. You know, Kishka's kidneys absorb things and they clean them out. Doesn't do work by the Barbara. No, he doesn't know exactly what he said. Okay, so you have this idea. So now, what do we have here?
Who's
we have on the one hand what?
Who's Yehuda?
who dome le Yehuda?
Just one second.
Is that the Maharal?
No, the Yitzchak Aramo, Yitzchak Barbino, I don't know who
he
is.
Is it? Is that like expression Yehuda Varamakor? Mm-hmm. It's a thing. It's not a guy.
Okay.
It's a guy.
Excuse
it's an expression.
Me, I didn't get what far from my kidneys means.
It means I don't like it.
Oh, I don't like it.
I don't like his interpretation. So I have, the way I see it now is we have two problems. One problem is Shabbat Lashem. Like what, I mean, you could accept Rashi's position that it's, that it has no literary importance. Or, we're missing, as the Kli Yakar said, that you have to somehow include Shabbat Lashem in your understanding of the mitzvah itself. Right? That's what we're missing. We're missing. Now I wanted to look at the rest of the sheet is Rav Kook. Rav Kook wrote a book called Shabbat HaAretz. Rav Kook wrote a book which was published and called Shabbat HaAretz. And that book is basically a commentary on the Rambam Shmita Hilchot Shmita V'Yovel, which the Rambam and the Mor Nevuchim that we read mentions. Again, the Rambam, in the Rambam we read from the Mor Nevuchim, the guide, mentions that he's talking about the halachot of Shmita and Yovel, which are found, again, in his work on halacha, called Hilchot Shmita V'Yovel, right? The end of the section, the large section, called Zra'im in the world of the Rambam. So this book Shabbat HaAretz is a commentary on the whole of the Rambam on Shmita V'Yovel. Furthermore, it contains a very long mavo discussing the specific problem of selling Eretz Yisrael, land in Eretz Yisrael, to non-Jews, so that you could eat the produce, of the land on the Shemitah year, right? That's the two big parts of the book. This idea that you could sell the land of Israel, they could sell the land of Eretz Yisrael, and therefore circumvent the problem of Shemitah. I mean, what happened was there were people who moved out of Mea Shearim and they went to Petach Tikva, they became farmers. And they asked the question, but this was in the 1880s, right? The 1880s, and they sent the question to Rabbi Yitzchok Chonan, who was then considered to be the premier halachic authority of the Jewish people, and they sent the Shaila to him in Krakow, and he was the one with a Beit Din that he assembled who said that the solution to the problem is to sell the land of Israel. But he added a proviso. And he said, since it's a very radical kind of idea, he thinks that it should be reinvestigated every 7 years. There was the Yisrael Chanan said, it's not a heter that will stand on its own forever, but every 7 years you should look into it again. The Rabbanim, whoever the poskim that you depend on, should look into it again and do it again. And so Rav Kook, when he was mater in the beginning of the 20th century, he was mater selling Eretz Yisrael to Goyim, he added the same proviso. He said, but check into it every time Shemitah comes up, because this is a very difficult heter. So that's what he wrote in the first part of the book, right? The second part of the book is the commentary on the Rambam. The first part of the book is about the heter Mechira. And all of this, what comes before all of this, is what he called Hakdama, where he tries to give us a basic understanding of what Shemitah is. And that's what we want to look at, okay? Ha-Shemitah v'Hayovel v'Zmanim mit Yachasim Zelazeh. There's some relationship between Shemitah every 7 years and Yovel once in 50 years. Right? 7 times 7. The next one is called Yovel. Kemo hachama v'alvana, like the sun and the moon. Ba'olam, ukemo Yisrael v'ha'adam b'nefashot, yachas aprat v'aklal, like, just like Yisrael and Adam. Right? Yisrael is like a community of people, that Adam is a single person. B'nefashot, yachas aprat v'aklal, this is something that Rav Kook liked to write about, right? That there was an entity called Klal Yisrael. And Klal Yisrael is judged, sometimes it seems that Klal Yisrael is judged differently than the individual in Yisrael. And so Rav Kook would come up with the idea that if a person, a single person is Mechalel Shabbat, then he will be punished for the Chilul Shabbat that he did. However, if the community of Israel, who is building the land and changing the world and making it a safe place for the Jewish people to continue and flourish, then the judgment of that cloud, right, includes the great things that they are doing. And so the individual in the cloud might not be punished for being Mechalel Shabbat, because he's part of the cloud that is creating the new entity for the Jewish people in Eretz Yisrael. Now you can understand that this might have got him into some trouble. He, Rav Kook, might have gotten into some trouble in trying to say that if a person is in the Mechalel Shabbat, it's not so terrible if he's also building the land of Israel. This was not an idea that went over so well with people who were traditional, and even with people who were Dati Le'umi. It was a hard idea to understand. But that's what he is saying. What is he saying? The next paragraph. Mi goy gadol, asher lo elokim kirovim elav. Skulata shel Knesset Yisrael hu, shehi mistakelet al ha'avaya kula, baspaklaria ha'meira shel kodesh. Bekol az chayeha hi makere. Listen, you see these words? He says, Sgulata shall Knesset Yisrael. Knesset Yisrael is some entity. I mean, we don't know about it. I mean, we can say Knesset Yisrael, but we can't identify it so easily. It's not part of our education. We haven't been taught to recognize Knesset Yisrael. But he thought Knesset Yisrael was obvious. There was a Knesset Yisrael, Shehi mistakelet al ha'avaya kula. Right, Knesset Yisrael, mistakelet. And we look at Knesset Yisrael. Knesset Yisrael looks at, and we look at, the totality of existence. And we say, is it better? Are things improving? Like, we can say that. We can say, look at Eretz Yisrael. Eretz Yisrael is the, like you could say two things. You say, this guy is a politician, and he does the wrong thing, right? He doesn't keep Shabbos. So it's very bad. And therefore, since most of the politicians in Israel are like that, so the whole thing is very bad, right? Or you could say, well, look at Israel. It's steadily producing a place where more and more people can learn Torah. Its result is a place where more and more people are able to keep the mitzvot and do the Torah. So even though those same politicians are the same, I mean, they may not be interested, but the Klal Yisrael seems to be interested as a cloud, where they seem to be doing the right thing. So you could say, well, I want to judge them as the cloud, being part of this cloud. So again, you say, if you live in Borough Park, no Borough Park. If you live in Teaneck, right, and you're Mechalel Shabbos for Vahesir, it's not a bad guy. But if you live in Israel, and you do Miluim, and you go to the army, and your kids are involved in building the land, so it's different. It's a different kind of situation. That's what Rav Kook, I think, that's what I think he thought. So now, we go on and we say, B'chol Eitz Chaim Hi Makeret, Shechayim Shavim Heim, et erkam rak bota midah shehem elokiyim. There's another idea that the medievalists all recognized that. Like Aristotle said, you know, that there's a domain, and there's chai, and there's man. Right? There's like the inanimate, the animate, you know, like flowers and animals, and you know, they just live on reflex. They do whatever they do. They never change. And then there's man. Man has this apparent ability to make decisions about how he/she will be. This idea, which comes from Aristotle, was accepted. Everybody accepts that. Even we accept that.
Can you just talk to me about what you said before from Rav Kook? Isn't it the total opposite of everything that the Torah seems to say?
Of what? Who says the, of the
what
Torah?
You're saying, yeah, because a simple reading of the Torah seems to say, if you don't have your in Eretz Yisrael, then it's 10 times worse.
Who's the you in this? I don't know, why is it 10 times worse? You mean talk about Shemitah?
The land will not let you out. The land doesn't tolerate.
Certain kinds of Averis. Certain Averis, not all the Averis. Shemitah and Arayas.
Otherwise you can do the Averis.
What?
Otherwise it's okay.
I didn't say it's okay. You'll be punished as an individual. But you don't have this. You don't have a national calamity. Shemitah and Arayos, right, the indiscriminate sexual transgressions, you create a national calamity. But if you're Mechalel Shabbos, Befarhesia, so you are punished. You don't create, we don't know that you create a national calamity. You're punished.
But we do.
What?
Sorry, do you mind me, Austin? But we do have a concept that the closer you come to Kedusha in general, the stricter and higher the standards.
Yeah, so.
And he seems to totally turn that on his
head. Well, what are you talking about? Nadav Aviyu? What are we talking about? There were just two people. They were killed. It didn't cause the exile of the Jewish people. No, in fact, by Rishon, the Gemara says they did every Aver in the book in order to get exiled. No?
I don't know. We have it like as we go through the Midbar and HaKadosh Baruch Hu kind of withdrawing because we can't cope.
Yeah, but we say that you're explaining, you're saying something that you think is correct. Maybe it is, but it doesn't say that in the Torah. It does say that if you don't keep Shemitah, you're going to be exiled. It says that in the Torah. It says if you don't act properly sexually, which the Rambam says also has to do with idolatry, then you're going to be exiled. That's what it says. It doesn't say if you're Mechal Shabbos you're going to be exiled. Although you could find a source someplace that says that. That, you know, because the opposite is true. The Gemara says that if you keep 2 Shabbatot or 3 Shabbatot, if all the Jewish people would keep Shabbos, then the exile would end. We would all be redeemed. Okay, you could find things like that, but you can't. But it doesn't say that in the Torah. It says it in the Gemara someplace. But the Torah doesn't say anything like that. Torah, Adarabah, Shoftim, Shoftim, Datein, Dechavet. You talk about individuals. The individual gets judged. The individual gets, not the, there's also a judgment for larger communities here, and Nidacha. We have all the variations. But generally, when you speak about punishment, you speak about punishment for an individual who did in a particular aveira. Okay, let's look at the Rav Kook. So here he says, Shebe'emet ein chayim ela elokiyim. In other words, not only is there a distinction between domain, chai, and man/woman, but we all understand that man is complicated because man, I don't have to keep saying this, woman, I'll say woman. Yeah. Because yes. Woman, I'll say woman. Okay, that'll work. So a woman is a combination of exalted potential, but pragmatic needs. Right? So you have to eat. You have to sleep. You have to dress warmly if it's cold. You have to turn on the air conditioner if it's hot. In other words, we are very much a product of our physicality. Right? So what prey could be the what he calls chayim elokiyim? Right? What the pasuk says, the pasuk he quoted above, right? Mi goy gadol asher elokim krovim elav. There's a how do we produce this idea of closeness to God? Well, the answer is, everybody will say the same thing, that you have in you this ability. You have some talent which enables you to come close to God. So you can say, for example, according to the Rambam, it's a mitzvah to daven. It's a mitzvah to daven once a day, any nusach you want, but there's a mitzvah to daven. Even those who disagree with the Rambam, like the Ramban, and others who say there's no mitzvah to daven, they agree that people daven. And the Tanakh is full of people who daven. And there's no doubt that when you feel somehow the weight of the world is upon you, you turn to God and you daven, right? That's a regular thing. Now in Chassidut they would say this. Rav Nachman also said this. He said that if God put the ability to daven into us, it must be that it works. It can't be that it doesn't work. Why would I mean? This is not Rabbi Soloveitchik's existential philosophy, but it's a different kind of philosophy. If we can daven, maybe you say, "All right, I've got to daven," you know, like Tevye in that play. You say, "Listen, I've had it. You know, I can't do it. I can't. There's no way. You've got to help me out, right?" So people do that. Now the buffaloes, they don't do that. They don't do that. They just take what meted out to them. You know, you shoot a buffalo, it just dies. It doesn't say Shema Yisrael on the way out of the world. But people have this capacity to daven. And if you have like a little cleverness, you say, the Rashi says, right? If you remember Rashi? V'odom ayin lavod et adama. So Rashi says, right, so the job of woman in the world is to daven. It's a daven, and if you daven, it's going to rain. And if you don't daven, it's not going to rain. Therefore, I come to this father, Rav Nachman, I think, came to the conclusion. So it's got to work. If you daven, it's got to work. So, but it seems to be counter-indicated. Like, it doesn't work. People daven, they daven for somebody's well-being, or for good health, or this, and nothing happens. It doesn't work. So you have to add a codicil to the original idea, which is that it's got to work. It'll only work if you are living chayim elokiyim. If you're coming close to God, as the pasuk says, shelo elohim krovim elav. If you are close to God, if you're not close to God, so you're not really davening. You're not using that talent that you have bestowed upon you, right? That will work. It'll work every time. It'll work every time. That's what Moshe Rabbeinu, why Moshe Rabbeinu was able to argue, that's a different thing than Rabbi Nachman said. That the reason that Moshe Rabbeinu was able to argue with God about Bnei Yisrael was because he was to the point of defense attorney. That was his job. There was a job. Rabbi Moshe Rabbeinu didn't say, gee, I mean, God wants to do them in, so that's it, though. Look for another job. But he argued with God. How can you argue with God? I mean, what was his svara, Moshe Rabbeinu? So the svara was, I am the appointed defense attorney for the Jewish people. If I'm the appointed defense attorney for the Jewish people, that means that I've got to be right. It's got to work. That's what it means to be the appointed defense attorney for the Jewish people. It's not that Moshe Rabbeinu had chutzpah, or he thought that his argument, he could come up with an argument that God never thought of. Well, it wasn't like that. It was that his job was to make the argument. And once he did his job, he knew it would work. So even after the Chet HaEgel, Moshe Rabbeinu said, I've got to argue, I've got to put forth the case. What did he say? He didn't have a case. He said, what will happen? People all over the world will think that God has not been able to pull it off, to get the Jews out of the tribe, you're going to kill them all. Which seems to me to be kind of a weak argument at best to present to God with. But it didn't matter. It didn't matter. Moshe Rabbeinu was the defense attorney. And as the defense attorney appointed by God, he knew that it would work. It had to work. There was no, because otherwise the appointment wouldn't be. There wouldn't have been an appointment. So that's what he talks about. תכונת נשמתה מטבעת עליה את חותם ערכה המיוחד לה המוטבע על כל יחיד ויחיד מהיחידה. So, but this is the primary quality that we have, that we can come close to God. And we usually think of coming close to God as like almost physical. Here's God, here's me, I'm going to come close to God. But coming close to God for the philosophers and for the Hasidim, who were also philosophers of a sort, meant that the God-like qualities in me are being pulled out. You know, they become dominant. They become my dominant qualities. So I would say this. What is it that we do when we keep Shemitah according to the Rambam? What we do is we create a just world. Right? There are fewer poor people. There are fewer people who haven't got anything to eat. We take a step in the direction of a just world. Now, when a Torah person says, I want to create a just world, it's not like a reformed Jew today, even though they're very nice, they're very fine, and they want to save the dolphins, it's very good, everything's fine. I'm not saying, but you see, the reformed Jews want to save the world because it seems to them that it's a good idea. Right? It seems that it's good. The Torah people don't think of it that way. They say it's the Torah opens with Gan Eden. That's what the Torah says. And therefore, as the Ramban says at the end of the Torah, therefore, because the Torah starts with Gan Eden, say, why did the Torah tell us about Gan Eden? Why does the Torah have to tell you that Adam and Chava got kicked out of Gan Eden? Why can't you start the story post Gan Eden? I mean, there's no Gan Eden, so what's the difference? So the answer probably is, the answer for all these other people, right, we're not saving the dolphins necessarily. The answer for all of those people is that Gan Eden presents us with the ultimate model. What's Gan Eden? Gan Eden was, you didn't really work too hard. You could eat whatever there was. Everybody had food to eat. And you could always talk to God. So that becomes like a theory. A theoretical model for actual life. He said, like, what do you want to do? I want everybody to have something to eat. I want everybody to be able to learn Torah. I want everybody to be able to involve themselves somehow in this great process. I want everybody to be in Gan Eden. Ah, I can't do it. I can't, what am I going to do? I'm going to jump off the roof. I can't do all of that. So along comes the Torah, intervenes. The Torah intervenes and says, yes, you've got the right idea. Can't do it, but once in 7 years, Shabbat Lashem, you create this reality. You create this reality once in 7 years. You could do it, right? Once in 7 years, and make the world sensitive to the fact that there might be a better world, which is what, in fact, Shabbat Lashem means. You make the Shabbat for the sake of God, for the sake of the world that God obviously wanted to create. So it turns out, if you like, just sort of squint a little bit, that the position that Rav Kook enunciated, which is that a person has to kind of feel God in what he is doing and see that becomes the dominant part of his personality. So he says, all of that is exactly the same as what the Rambam said. Of course, I know it's not, but I'm just saying it for the sake of, like, you know, to make it something sound good. So the Rambam said that what do you do on Shemitah? You take care of things that you ordinarily cannot take care of.
It didn't annoy
me, but it annoyed everybody else. So the Rambam says on Shemitah, on the Shemitah year, excellent, thank you very much. I'm very glad you came.
There's a reason for everything.
I spoke.
You see, he's sitting on his side.
So you see, let me say it one more time with less enthusiasm. The Rambam says that the reason that you keep Shemitah is because you create within the big world a better world. Right? You're able to function better, the crops are going to grow better, the people are going to have what to eat in spite of the fact that you're not producing that much, and your gross national product has gone down, but you still are going to be sensitized. You're going to be sensitized to the needs of others. Rav Kook says, look, you know, we're always searching for a life that connects us to the divine, that uses our special talents in order to make it possible for the world to be a better world. What's a better world? That's Gan Eden. You want to make Gan Eden. Gan Eden is a place where people had a lot of spare time. Right? You were able to devote. I mean, I know that some things happened in Gan Eden that were not so good. But the idea of Gan Eden is that in some ultimate way, there's a better life. There's a life that takes you out of whatever it is you're involved with and weighs you down and opens the door to a different kind of life, a life of different kinds of opportunities. And so you see that while they're certainly different, Rav Kook and the Rambam on this matter come together. And so I'll say one last thing before I stop. You know the Baal HaTanya, I think I told you the story, the Baal HaTanya was in a town called Lubavitch, and he had a yeshiva. This is what they say. I mean, he certainly had a yeshiva, but this is a story. So he had a yeshiva. At the yeshiva, there were three classes in the yeshiva. The first class, on the first floor, the students had to learn Nigma. They had to know everything, the Shas and the Shulchan Aruch. That's what they learned in the first floor. When they finished learning all that stuff, they moved up to the second floor. And they learned all the Kabbalistic works that existed at the time, and they had to know them very well, and the Baal HaTanya would come and give them exams, etc., etc. But they finished the second floor. The first floor is Nigla, second floor is Nistar. The third floor was the Rambam. Because the Baal HaTanya said, it's all in the Rambam. It's all the Rambam. So here we did this. With the memory of the Baal HaTanya in mind, it's all in the Rambam. Okay, have a good.